You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro. Write the Book is the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. And today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Vermont author Jennifer McMahon, whose new novel is called The Winter People. Jennifer McMahon was born in 1968 and grew up in her grandmother's house in suburban Connecticut, where Jennifer was convinced a ghost named Virgil lived in the attic. She wrote her first short story in third grade. Jennifer graduated with a BA from Goddard College in 1991 and then studied poetry for a year in the MFA in writing program at Vermont College. A poem turned into a story, which turned into a novel, and she decided to take some time to think about whether to write poetry or fiction. After bouncing around the country, she wound up back in Vermont, living in a cabin with no electricity, running water, or phone, with her partner, Drea, while they built their own house. Over the years, Jennifer has been a house painter, farm worker, paste-up artist, Easter bunny, pizza delivery person, homeless shelter staff member, and counselor for adults and kids with mental illness. She quit her last real job in 2000 to work on writing full-time. In 2004, she gave birth to a daughter, Zella. These days, Drea, Jennifer, and Zella live in an old Victorian in Montpelier, Vermont. Some neighbors think it looks like the Addams Family house, which brings Jennifer immense pleasure. I spoke with Jennifer McMahon a couple of weeks ago in her home in Montpelier. I asked her to begin by reading from The Winter People. This is the beginning of an early chapter, which follows a very brief prologue.
Visitors from the Other Side, The Secret Diary of Sarah Harrison Shea. January 29th, 1908. The first time I saw a sleeper, I was 9 years old. It was the spring before Papa sent Auntie away, before we lost my brother Jacob. My sister Constance had married the fall before and moved up to Graniteville. I was up exploring in the woods near the Devil's Hand, where Papa had forbidden us to play. The trees were leafing out, making a lush green canopy overhead. The sun had warmed the soil, giving the damp woods a rich, loamy smell. Here and there beneath the beech, sugar maple, and birch trees were spring flowers, trilliums, trout lilies, and my favorite, Jack in the Pulpit, a funny little flower with a secret. If you lift the striped hood, you'll find the preacher underneath. Auntie had showed me this and taught me that you could dig up the tubers and cook them like turnips. I had just found one and was pulling back the hood, looking for the tiny figure underneath, when I heard footsteps, slow and steady, moving my way. Heavy feet dragging through dry leaves, stumbling on roots. I wanted to run, but froze with panic, having squatted down low behind a rock just as a figure moved into the clearing. I recognized her at once, Hester Jameson. She'd died 2 weeks before from typhoid fever. I had attended her funeral with Papa and Jacob, seen her laid to rest in the cemetery behind the church up by Cranberry Meadow. Everyone from school was there, all in Sunday best. Hester's father, Irwin, ran Jameson's tack and feed shop. He wore a black coat with frayed sleeves, and his nose was red and running. Beside him stood his wife, Cora Jameson, a heavyset woman who had a seamstress shop in town. Mrs. Jameson sobbed into a lace handkerchief, her whole body heaving and trembling. I had been to funerals before, but never for someone my own age. Usually it was the very old or the very young. I couldn't take my eyes off the casket, just the right size for a girl like me. I stared at the plain wooden box until I grew dizzy, wondering what it might feel like to be laid out inside. Papa must have noticed, because he took my hand and gave it a squeeze, pulled me a little closer to him. Reverend Ayers, a young man then, said Hester was with the angels. Our old preacher, Reverend Phelps, was stooped over, half deaf, and none of what he said made any sense. It was all frightening metaphors about sin and salvation. But when Reverend Ayers, with his sparkling blue eyes, spoke, it felt as if he said each word right to me. I am he who will sustain you. I have made you, and I will carry you. I will sustain you, and I will rescue you. For the first time, I understood the word of God because Reverend Ayers spoke it. His voice, all the girls said, could soothe the devil himself. A red-winged blackbird cried out "Conquerie" from a nearby hazel bush. He puffed up his red shoulders and sang over and over as loud as he could, his call almost hypnotic. Even Reverend Ayers paused to look. Mrs. Jameson dropped to her knees, keening. Mr. Jameson tried to pull her up, but did not have the strength. I stood right beside Papa, clutching his hand as dirt was shoveled down on the coffin of poor Hester Jameson. Hester had a crooked front tooth, but a beautifully delicate face. She had been best in the class at arithmetic. Once, for my birthday, she gave me a note with a flower pressed inside. A violet it was, dried out and perfectly preserved. "May your day be as special as you are," she'd written in perfect cursive. I tucked it into my Bible, where it stayed for years, until it either disintegrated or fell out. I cannot recall. Now, 2 weeks after her very own funeral, Hester's sleeper caught sight of me there in the woods, crouching behind the rock. I shall never forget the look in her eyes, the frightened half-recognition of someone waking from a horrible dream. I had heard about sleepers. There was even a game we played in the schoolyard in which one child would be laid out dead in a circle of violets and forget-me-nots. Then someone would lean down and whisper magic words in the dead girl's ear, and she would rise and chase all the other children. The first one she caught would be the next to die. I think I may have even played this game once with Hester Jameson. I had heard whispers, rumors of sleepers called back from the land of the dead by grieving husbands and wives, but was certain that they existed in the stories old women liked to tell each other while they folded laundry or stitched stockings. Something to pass the time, and to make any eavesdropping children hurry home before dark. I had been sure, up until then, that God in his infinite wisdom would not have allowed such an abomination. Hester and I were not 10 feet apart. Her blue dress was filthy and torn, her corn silk hair in tangles. She gave off the musty smell of damp earth. But there was something else behind it, an acrid, greasy, burnt odor, similar to what you smell when you blow out a tallow candle. Our eyes met, and I yearned to speak, to say her name, but could only manage a strangle-sounding hiss. Hester ran off into the woods like a startled rabbit. I stayed frozen, clinging pathetically to my rock like a bit of lichen. From down the path leading to the Devil's Hand came another figure, running, calling Hester's name. It was her mother, Cora Jameson. She stopped when she saw me, face flushed and frantic. She was breathing hard and had scratches on her face and arms, pieces of dried leaves and twigs tangled in her hair. "Tell no one," she said. "But why?" I asked, stepping out from behind the rock. She looked right at me, through me almost, as if I were a pane of dirty window glass. "Someday, Sarah," she said, "maybe you'll love someone enough to understand." Then she ran off into the woods, following her daughter.
Thank you so much for reading that. That's wonderful. You know, hearing you read that just now, I'm going to, you know, not go right to my first question, but hearing you read that right now, the detail of the smell of the tallow candle, you know, the kind of burnt, greasy smell, mm-hmm. I think it's challenging to come up with new smells.
It is.
That's a good one.
You know, when I'm revising a book, I try to go through and, because, you know, when I do a first draft, it's messy and all over the place. And one of the things I do when I'm revising is I go through and I try to think about adding in things from all the senses.
Yes,
so
absolutely.
I'm really, you know, I go through and I'm thinking about things, the way things sound and taste and smell. And,
right.
And so I try to put in little details like that. But that was just a little gem that popped out. And I was like, oh, that's exactly what it was.
That's
like.
Really good. That's really good. I like that one. So here's my first actual question. Do you ever scare yourself when you're writing?
Oh, all the time.
You do?
I am such a big scaredy cat. I'm one of those people who you can't take. I love to go to scary movies and read scary books, but I'm terrified and I have to sleep with the light on and I'm just a mess and I'm covering up my eyes in the movie theater and I'm wondering what I'm doing there and I'm thinking, I can't watch this, it's too scary. And I'm putting the book down if I'm reading a scary book and turning on the light and making my partner Drea get up. And
what about when you're writing your
and
own
when
book?
When I'm writing my own book, yes. And I am absolutely, I scare myself all the time. And when I was writing this book, I scared myself. There were a couple of scenes. There's one scene in particular where there's a scene where Martin is wakes up and finds Sarah in front of the closet, and he hears noises in the closet. And that scared the living daylights out of me.
Yeah, that closet was scary.
The closet was very scary. But I know that if I'm sitting at the computer and I'm giving myself chills and goosebumps, I know that that must be good.
That's a good thing. I think it definitely
is. It's a good thing. But yeah, I do scare myself. And this book scared me more than any other that I've done, definitely. Yeah. I think it's the scariest.
Well, I found it very scary and very good, creepy in a great way.
Yeah.
Is Vermont a particularly conducive locale for a ghost story or for a scary story, do you think?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think so. I think Vermont is such an important part of my books. And I think that that setting is almost a character in and of itself. And
right.
Vermont is just the perfect setting for something like this. And, when I decided to set a book, this was the first book that I decided to do sort of a historical thing. Part of the book is set in 1908 Vermont. And that was just so perfect,
yeah.
Imagining what it would be like to be out in the middle of nowhere in this farmhouse and have no electricity and winter sets in and winter's really hard and you're way off the beaten path and there are no snow plows, there's no lights to flip on, there's no central heating. Life is hard and creepy.
Yeah. And there's no phones. And even in your more contemporary setting, sometimes the phones aren't always available.
The phones aren't always bad, yeah.
So the Winter People concerns the stories of three groups of people in two mm-hmm. different time periods. So I wondered, at what point did you know who the major characters were going to be and how you would tell their story?
I had Sarah's point of view pretty early on. Although honestly, when I first set out to write the Winter People, it was a completely different book. I sat down to write a story about a Civil War soldier.
Oh, wow.
And when I sit down to write a story, I don't have a plan or an outline and I have no idea where I'm going to be taken. So I sat down and I was writing a story about a guy marching home from the Civil War back to Vermont. And he's having flashbacks to his childhood and he's thinking about his wife and he's gone AWOL from the army, and he was a Union Army soldier. And I thought, I don't know anything about the Civil War. What am I doing? So I started to do research about the Civil War. And I watched that Ken Burns documentary on the Civil War, which is just amazing. And there was this little tiny piece in there about Abraham and Mary Todd Lincoln's young son dying in the White House. Mm-hmm. And how Mary Todd was grief-stricken, of course. But then she came to believe that he came and his ghost came and visited her. And then she became a spiritualist and started having seances in the White House. And something just clicked in my brain. I said, I don't want to write a book about a Civil War soldier. I want to write a book about a spiritualist at the turn of the century in Vermont. So I kind of did a fast forward, and I took my Civil War soldier, and I made him I turned him into the character of Martin. And so he was this farm husband.
Yeah.
And I gave him a wife who was going to be the spiritualist, Sarah. And I decided that they would have a child who died, and it would be really terrible, but that's okay because Sarah would become a spiritualist or would have already been a spiritualist and would believe she could still communicate with her and that she wasn't really gone. She was just gone from this world, but that she was still out there. And so I thought, this is a good idea for a story. So I start writing this story, and then stories just kind of take on a life of their own, and the characters kind of surprise you sometimes. And I was doing all the diary entries for Sarah out in longhand in my notebook because I think maybe because I'd been reading about spiritualism so much and I was reading about channeling and spirit writing and that's how I really got into Sarah's voice was by writing. And one day I get this line, which was the first time I saw a sleeper. I was 9 years old and it just came to me from nowhere, but it was right there and I was like, wow, what's a sleeper? And that was one of those moments where I definitely scared myself and I got chills and I wasn't sure I wanted to know what a sleeper was because it sounded really scary, but I had to keep writing to find out. And as I wrote, I discovered I wasn't writing about a story about a woman who believes she can communicate with her dead daughter. I was writing a story about a woman who believes she can bring her dead daughter back to life, which is even creepier.
Yeah.
And then the whole book took a turn.
Oh,
and so,
wow.
I think that's what makes it fun and magical for me, is I can start with something completely different than what I end up with.
Right,
and the story it's like I'm following a path and it twists and turns and I have no idea what's going to happen next.
And I think that sort of organic process makes such a better read for the reader too.
Yeah, and it's more fun for me. You know, the only time I tried to actually do an outline and write from an outline, I was so bored. I was miserable.
And so even after you have the basic threads in place, you're not outlining what happens next?
I don't. So I had Sarah and Martin's story, and, several years before that, I had this idea about writing this. I was playing a game with my daughter, and I got completely inspired. She was pretty young at the time, maybe 6 or so. Her games at the time were these really imaginative dramas, and it was almost like an improv exercise in an acting class. She said, here's the game, Mom. We're sisters. You're 17, you're 19, I'm 7, and you wake up one morning and I'm in bed beside you, and I tell you our parents are missing. It's like, missing, what happened to them? That's terrible, my poor love. We're warping my daughter. And she said they were taken into the woods. And I'm like, oh, my God, I'm totally warping this child. And I'm looking at her, I'm like, oh, this is terrible. And she shrugged her shoulders and said very nonchalantly, sometimes it just happens. And I said, you know what? That sounds like an idea for one of Mommy's books. And so I wrote down the idea and I started thinking about it. And then I just kind of, I put it away. And that's, I think, one of the wonderful things about ideas is that once you acknowledge them and write them down, you can put them away. And then I have this idea. I actually have an idea box. I could show it to you. It's really cool. It's a little bigger than a shoebox.
Yeah.
And I put all my ideas that I think are good ideas into the box. And I think that, you know, if once I've given them life and put them in there, they're maybe drawing other ideas to them.
Yeah.
So I had this idea about the Missing Sisters book. And then I just kind of forgot about it and put it away. And then as I'm writing the story about Sarah and the spiritualist, I remembered the missing sister, the sisters with the missing parents. And I said, those sisters with their missing parents belong in my book, and they're going to live in Sarah's house in the present day, and they're going to wake up one morning, and their mother's going to be missing, and it's somehow going to be tied to what happened with Sarah all those years ago. And it just was this another one of those magical cha-ching moments where everything
right.
just kind of fits into place.
So, if you have different pieces that you know you want to have eventually fit together,
yeah.
will you go through phases of not writing because you haven't figured out how they fit together yet?
No. I just plunge full steam.
You just keep going.
You know, and a good example of that is Catherine's character. She just came to me,
yeah.
and I knew I wanted her in the story, but I had no idea how she fit in. I had no idea what she was doing in town. She comes to town because her husband has died recently. He'd been killed in an accident on his way back from the small town of West Hall, Vermont. And, you know, I didn't know what she was doing there. I didn't know what his story was. I didn't know what her story was. I had no plan for her. She came to me out of nowhere. She was an artist. She's grief-stricken. She's kind of depressed. I'm like, what? How does she fit into all this? And I just had to keep writing to figure it out.
Yeah.
But if I had stopped to try to plan it all out, then I would probably still be stuck.
Okay. All right. That's great.
But, yeah, no, I just have to, I think, for me, I have to kind of have faith in the story and in the story taking me where it wants to go and
okay.
sort of almost trusting the characters in the story.
I want to talk a little bit about the account of Sarah Harrison Shea, the one
mm-hmm.
you just read about. You read her childhood narrative. And her story takes place in the earliest 20th century, as we've said, and is always introduced, at least at first, through diary entries.
Mm-hmm.
So I wondered if you can talk a little bit about using her journey as a way, her journal as a way into her story.
Yeah, that was the way for me to get into her character. The easiest, I think, was I wrote all her journal entries out longhand. And I, you know, when I decided to write a story that was set that far back, I was completely overwhelmed. I was like, what am I doing? I don't know what I'm doing. So I did all this research, and one of the things that I did was I read a lot of diaries and letters from that time period from Vermont and New England, and that really helped me to get her voice. And it just came naturally to me that she would be writing in a journal, and she would be confessing, and that's where she would go to confess her deepest secrets and fears, and what she really thinks is happening would be in
right.
her journal. And she's hiding her journals later on and keeping them from her husband. And then I decided to have her husband Martin's point of view in there, which would sort of be a nice counterpoint.
Right.
You know, like and as the reader, we're wondering, as I was writing it, I'm wondering, is this really happening? Is Sarah going mad? Is she just slipping into madness? Does she really see these things? Is it possible that Gertie's back? I don't know.
Right.
Then we have Martin and his brother absolutely sure that Sarah's just gone off the deep end and should be put in the state hospital.
Right, although Martin has secrets of his own, too.
Martin does have secrets of his own, yes.
So that kind of also puts another little twist into it,
yeah.
which is interesting. I loved that you told Martin's story. So you always sort of introduce that time period through a journal entry, and then in the same section of the book, but the next chapter, will be perhaps from Martin's point of view, and it's not a journal entry, but the journal kind of got us back there. And I liked that. I'd never seen that before, where the journal gets us into a time period, into a story, but then the other characters will also have narrative points of view, and I liked that.
Thank you. Yeah. I had fun with that, and the journal entries was an easy way for me to get into it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that was great. Yeah. Okay. There's also, in addition to the story that the journal tells, the journal kind of plays a part of its own as an artifact within the story. And there's also an important ring that mm-hmm. plays a role. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the value of artifacts within a mystery. I mean, I do feel like this is more than a mystery, but there's a mystery to this story. And
mm-hmm.
I feel like those artifacts play a role.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's...
Yeah, I think artifacts and kind of talismans and things of great importance and almost magical quality are really fascinating to me. And the journal is not only Sarah's journal, but in it she's recounting the story of how she supposedly brings her daughter Gertie back to life in it. And within the journal are contained the secrets, sort of, as I was writing it, I called it the recipe for bringing the dead back to life. You know, she writes it down and it's there in black and white. And a lot of people believe in it, and a lot of people want this secret for themselves.
Right.
And
although the secret itself is not in the journal,
it's not in the journal,
because
she's hidden pages all over the house, and she's
we won't give everything away. So I just felt like that was so important. Like, I don't know, like these little physical clues that we can kind of focus our. You know, everybody knows what an interesting ring looks like or can picture their own interesting ring.
And one of the things that was fun for me was having it in 1908 and then showing what has happened to it since then, and then having it in the present day and showing how these people got a hold of it, and sort of and a physical object connects the past and the present.
Right.
And is pulling us back and forth.
Yeah,
so.
That was really interesting too. Yeah. Okay. So, as I just said, your works often have some aspect of mystery and the supernatural in them. And I'm just wondering if you can talk about the pros and cons of writing within a certain genre.
Yeah, you know, I don't think... People always ask me what genre my books are in.
Right.
I never know how to answer that.
Right, and I don't even know that I think your books are in a certain genre, but they do have these aspects of mystery and the supernatural.
Yeah.
So to that extent, I guess.
Yeah, so I'm not thinking about... Oh, I'm not thinking about genre at all when I'm writing.
Right,
I'm
not asking you to label it.
Yeah, so I'm trying to write the best story I can. And for me, you know, when I pick up a book that I'm trying to write the story that I would most want to read.
Right.
And for me, that would have a mystery element. I'm very much drawn to the dark side, the supernatural side. I think that this, you know, some of my books have had sort of supernatural elements, but this is my most, like, definite, like, supernatural, dead coming back to life.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like I really kind of went above and beyond this time, and I had so much fun.
It's really fun. And I think the other thing as a reader that I really enjoyed about this book is that it doesn't leave too much so far out there that we can't figure out what's supposed to be going on.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I liked that. I liked that it's got a supernatural aspect, but it ties into our reality in a way that we can understand.
I think that's important. And I couldn't write like true fantasy where you're off in another universe and there's a whole other set. I don't think I could do that. I like to write about the actual like concrete world that we all know, but maybe show us another side that we might not see every day, or that maybe some of us have an inkling that it might be there.
Yeah.
And I think that we're all kind of a little fascinated by
that.
And, you know, and as I was writing it, you know, I was thinking, I kept asking myself the question, what if I knew how to bring someone back? You know, what if I lost someone I loved? And would I give anything to see them again? Would I do it? No, of course I wouldn't do it, because terrible things would happen. But then I'm thinking, but really, would I really not do it? I think I would probably do it. You know, if I lost my partner or my little girl, I would probably do just about anything to see them again, even if I knew the consequences would be terrible.
Right, yeah.
You know? Yeah. I don't know. I hate to say that, but I think it's terrible.
Well, I mean,
it really got me thinking.
It's a relief that you don't have to worry about...
No, that's true.
You have to do that, because the journal has not yet been found. You just read this, but I'm going to read a little tiny bit of it again, because it's relevant to a question I want to ask you. The first time I saw a sleeper, I was 9 years old. It was the spring before Papa sent Auntie away, before we lost my brother Jacob. My sister Constance had married the fall before and moved to Graniteville. I was up exploring in the woods near the Devil's Hand, where Papa had forbidden us to play. I'm just going to go that far and talk a little bit about using detail, kind of a spare list of elements of people and places and character and story. I mean, you're kind of telling us things that we don't know anything about yet. You're listing off characters. And yet, for me, that just drew me into the story completely. I wanted to know what this story was, and it didn't overwhelm me. But I think that too much of that could overwhelm somebody. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about using this kind of spare detail to build tension and make a reader want to know more.
Yeah, I think that I introduced a lot, but as you pointed out, I didn't go too far into detail. You know, I gave us a few characters,
right?
And the opening sentence, the first time I saw a sleeper, you know, when I first wrote that line, I immediately needed to know what a sleeper was. So I was hoping that as a reader, that was my big hook.
And it gives you shivers right away.
It gives you shivers, and you're like, what? I have to keep reading to find out what this is.
Yeah.
And then I give the landscape, the Devil's Hand detail. You know, there's an area on the hill on the backside of Sarah's farmhouse where there's a rock outcropping called the Devil's Hand, and it's such an important part of the story, and I wanted to mention that right away. And I think that just the name, the Devil's Hand, and Papa, that place where Papa had forbidden her to play.
Yes,
you know,
which is a wonderful little like, well, why is she there?
I think, you know, when you're writing an opening, you want people to keep reading, you know.
Yeah,
because you know, sometimes I pick up a book and it loses me in the first page, and I have a lot of books on my to be read pile, and if something doesn't, I'm not a very patient reader. If something doesn't hook me on the first page, I put it down and I move on to another book.
Right.
I probably should give books a little longer. And if it's, you know, if it's something I'm really invested in, or I've heard really good things about, or a good friend has recommended, or even a friend has written, I'll keep reading. But usually I don't, you know, if something doesn't grab me right away. So that's my goal, is to try to grab people right away.
Right.
And I think that it's easy to kind of overwhelm people. You know, I wouldn't want to say the first time I saw a sleeper, I was 9 years old, and then go into her whole family history and bog everyone down with details.
And what you did do, which I think probably is just something natural that you do as you write, and that you weren't thinking about this necessarily, but you gave us enough to draw us in, and then you went into the detail of surroundings that's up on that hill, you know, the flowers and the way the rocks look, and I'm not remembering because I'm not looking at it right now, but, you know, and specific detail that we can all see in our minds because we do know those details, you know, we do know what that looks like. And it sort of keeps us from getting overwhelmed.
Yeah, and in that setting, I can go back and do little flashbacks into, you know, being with her father at at Hester's funeral, and little details about school and little day-to-day things, but then be pulled back into the landscape of the present moment in up at the Devil's Hand and what's going on.
I thought it was a very effective opening. All right.
An early draft of this, that scene came much later. Like, that diary entry came much later. And, you know, my agent read it and he said, this belongs at the beginning of the book. And I said, you're absolutely right. This is the beginning.
Okay. That's interesting. Oh, good.
So, and you had asked me, I know I'm kind of backtracking here, but you had asked me earlier about outlining. And I said I didn't outline, but that's not entirely true, because once I have a draft, once I write my messy first draft, then I outline. Then I take everything. What I do is I print it out, and it's messy and sprawling, and usually doesn't make any sense. And I've got all these characters, but I have I understand the basic arc of the story.
Yes.
And I lay it out. I move the furniture, and I lay it out in here and in here, and I cover the floor of my living room and dining room. I lay it out chapter by chapter, and then I start walking around in circles, and I move things around, and I think, oh, this doesn't belong here. This belongs there, and this needs to go out entirely, and there's a missing hole here where this scene needs to happen, so I'll take a piece of paper and write in the missing scene. And then there's something about it's almost like doing a collage. There's something that engages a different part of my brain, I think, when I see it all laid out on the floor, and it's like doing a puzzle piece. You know, it's like doing a puzzle, and I have to make everything fit. And then once I've got that, that becomes sort of my map, and then I sit down and work from that on the outline.
Okay.
And that's when I really add in like the layers of suspense and mystery, and I make sure everything kind of adds up, and I start thinking, you know, I start putting in the red herrings and start putting, you know. And
are you liable at that point to change anything major, like a beginning or an ending?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, sure. Yeah. No, everything's up for change.
Oh, okay.
Definitely.
All right, I want to talk about one of your characters, Catherine, who's an artist.
Okay.
And she makes small boxes that depict active scenes. And she's the one you mentioned before, whose husband has died in an accident. And so the boxes that she's making in the novel are sort of boxes that recreate their life together, but also that she's trying to answer questions about his death in one of these things that she's making. So I wonder if you can talk about the value of her work in the novel. Like, what do the boxes contribute to the story, do you think?
I think the boxes are kind of her you know, she's using the boxes to try to understand her relationship with Gary and to try to understand, you know, the box that she's working on is called Gary's Last Meal. So she's trying to, she moved to West Hall to figure out what brought her husband here on his last day alive. And she's working on this project, this little three-dimensional image of him having lunch at this cafe in West Hall, Vermont. And she's hoping that as she works on the box, that she'll come to understand, you know, that answers will come to her she's doing it. And I don't know, it was almost like a scene within a scene, you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And I had so much fun with that, and I thought it was sort of the perfect, at first I was going to have her be a painter, then I thought, no, that's not nearly as good as this, and here she's making a little Gary in miniature and putting him in a restaurant scene.
Yeah.
And she's searching for details and trying, and it was the one scene, because of the other boxes that she's done are scenes that she was present at and things from her life. You know, she has a one called The Wedding Vows where she and Gary are getting married, and she incorporates some other details into that. But this is just something she's completely imagined. You know, she knows that he came to this little cafe in Vermont and had his last meal there, but she doesn't. And then she comes to learn that he met someone. He met a woman, and she doesn't know anything. And then she learns, oh, it was a woman with a braid, and people call her the egg lady. And she starts to put little details together, and it's sort of, it's, yeah, it's her way in.
Yeah.
I almost feel like the box is sort of her doorway.
It's almost like Sarah's journal, Catherine's box.
Yeah, Catherine's box.
Bring them and us into their part of the story.
And the end of, you know, of her, of Catherine's, when we leave Catherine, she's finishing up the box.
Right.
And I think that was a really good way to end.
For closure for Catherine.
Well, closure and then...
closure, new complications.
New complications.
Now, I'm just going to read a couple sentences, if I may, from Catherine's section. Catherine believed that when the work was going well, things just fell into place as if by magic. It was the artist's job to open herself up, let herself be guided to whatever the next step might be. Today was not a day when things were going well. Of course, I'm thinking of you, at your journal or at your laptop computer, and that some days are better than others, and some days feel like they're like magic. So what do you do when the writing is not going well?
Oh, boy. I have a lot of things that I do. I'll switch point of views. Like, for example, when I was working on this, and I was stuck and I was hitting a wall with the backstory section with Sarah and Martin, then I would work on a Catherine section or I would work on a Ruthie section. But if that wasn't coming together either, you know, the best thing that I do is just take a break and go for a walk.
Yeah.
And when I'm going for a walk, I try really hard not to think about the book at all and just sort of notice my surroundings. And particularly going for a walk in the winter was wonderful. And sometimes I would go snowshoeing or skiing and
creep myself out
in the woods. Then I'd come back very inspired, heart racing, terrified. I was ready to write the next scene. So that's one thing. I do all kinds of things. I take out big sheets of newsprint and kind of brainstorm to get myself out of situations sometimes. Sometimes if I'm sitting at the laptop and typing, the best thing I can do is walk away from the laptop and write things out in my journal instead. So I've got a bunch of little tricks that I try. I have found that it's easy for me to decide, well, the work isn't going well, I'm not going to write. I can just stay away from work for a while, and then I get cranky when I'm not working. And, yeah, I make myself push through eventually. After I get back from the walk, I'll make myself sit down at the desk and try something. Find another way in. Something with her box.
That sounds like a good idea, because you don't want to kind of leave this unaddressed problem, because then it becomes easy to just keep leaving.
Absolutely, and I've done that before. I've, said, well, I'm going to wait for inspiration, and I could be waiting for weeks probably for inspiration, and meanwhile, nothing's happening, and then things aren't progressing, and I'm getting crankier, and the block is getting bigger, so it's better to just...
It's very self-perpetuating, isn't it?
It is, and I feel like even if I sit down and make myself write, and it's just crappy writing that day, it's okay, because I'm getting words on paper, I'm getting something down, and I can fix it later.
Yeah.
I can go back and fix it later.
Okay. All right, great. All right, another character from our third group of people is Ruthie. And one aspect of her character is that she's claustrophobic, which we hear about early in the story, and then it kind of, you touch on it throughout. It kind of haunted me as I was reading this, because I thought her claustrophobia was Chekhov's gun. You know, I mean, this was going to go off at some point, right? And I don't want to get into the details and ruin anything, but can you just talk about using weakness or phobia to create character and, in some cases, suspense and tension?
I think that we all have our weaknesses and our Achilles heel. And yeah, I think that for any great I think that's part of the overall character arc, is that the character has to face their deepest fears and face their number one problem and either deal with it or not, but it's going to come up.
Yeah, it's going to come up.
For sure, and it's part of the overall journey that they have to go on. You know, they've got sort of the internal problem, and then they've got the external. Ruthie's got the external, like her mom is missing. That's her big external problem. Right. One of her many internal problems is she's got this terrible claustrophobia. And there's a story for where, you know, I gave her the claustrophobia for a reason. You know, she developed the claustrophobia
For a good reason,
yes.
I really enjoyed her story. I liked all these stories, but for some reason I kind of latched on to Ruthie's situation because she's also sort of like an older teenager, but she's still a teenager, and she's still living, you know, the life of a high school student, or, you know.
She is, and she wants to get out of her small town. She's not happy. She wants to go to a big city and go away. She can't wait.
And she wants to have fun.
She wants to party.
Right.
She wants to do things with her life,
right.
and then wakes up and her mom's missing, and she's stuck with her little sister, and
all of a sudden she's got all this responsibility that she did not ask for,
and she doesn't. Yeah, so she's kind of floundering, but she grows a lot.
Yeah,
you know?
I enjoyed reading her story.
I did,
and I thought it was very believable. I mean, you know, there are certain teenagers that would not be up to this sort of thing, but I felt like she has been exposed enough to work, even though she didn't always want to do the work. She's been exposed enough. She knows what to do to keep them afloat.
Yeah, she does. Yeah, her mom taught her well. Her mom taught her to garden and cook and clean and take care of things and to be self-sufficient. And so she knows she's got all the skills. So
Good.
There she is. Not the situation she would choose for herself at all, but...
I have already said I found myself drawn into the book early on, and then the more I read, the faster the pages were turning for me. This might be a little bit of an out there question, but I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how you choose to release information to the reader in order to capitalize on that sense of wanting to, like, turn the pages faster and faster.
I think there's always a danger of telling too much too soon.
Okay.
You know, so I try to do little trail of breadcrumbs to have you keep turning the pages. And, you know, as I'm writing, also, it's a little trail of breadcrumbs for me, too, because I don't know what's going to happen next.
Right.
So I give myself these little things, like, ooh. and I try to leave a section with something, not necessarily a cliffhanger, but just a little piece that makes you want to turn the page and keep going.
Right.
And I, you know, it was especially challenging because of the time shifts. You know, I always worry writing a book with time shifts where we're jumping back and forth that it's going to be too jarring to leave one time period and one character and move into another. And you're going to have a hard time getting into the new one, and the transitions are going to be too difficult. So I had to work really hard at trying to make sure those flowed and trying to make sure I was, you know, leaving at a good place and jumping in at a place where you were picking right up on it and being like, oh, I'm with her again. Okay, great. What's going on with Ruthie? Because we had left her and this terrible thing was happening, and where is she now?
I think that's important, though, because when you start a book, you're still learning who the characters are, and you're still figuring out who you're going to find yourself invested in. And by the time you get to the point where the pages, for me, where the pages were turning faster and faster, I do think that's really important. Every single new chapter was about somebody I had become invested in by that point. And so I knew where they had been last, and I wanted to, oh, good, okay, so what's now what's happening with her? And I think when an author does that poorly, I'm getting to that, and I'm like, no, don't leave this one behind.
Yeah.
I still want to. I'm not ready to let go of this one yet. So that's a balancing act, I would think.
It is, and you know, toward the end of the book, the changes happen are fast and fair. The chapters are much shorter, a few chapters, and I'm switching back and forth more. But I feel like by that point, you've been with the characters enough that making the jumps works.
It did,
hopefully.
It did for me. Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that kind of ratchets up the tension, too, going back and forth like that and leaving certain characters in peril in the past and then coming to the present and putting the characters in the present in peril, and then you jump back to the past and, oh, are those people okay? What's going on? And they're kind of playing off each other, and
Okay. Your books have done very well. You've had some big publishers and big book book deals, I'm going to say. I don't know the details of your book deals, but, you know, you've had the support of some heavy-hitting publishers. And I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about being an author in the spotlight and how you carry that. Like, how is that ever hard, like, in a little town? Are there people coming up and asking you about your work? And is that really fun? Or sometimes is it sort of like, I'm awkward. I feel uncomfortable.
That's a good question. I'm the queen of the introverts, and I'm most comfortable when I'm sitting in front of my computer doing my work.
Right.
And the hardest part for me is always getting up and going off into the world and reading and meeting people.
That's interesting.
It's hard, but I also love it.
Okay.
You know, meeting all these great readers and meeting booksellers. And, you know, I did this time around, I did my first, like, national book tour, and I went all over the country.
Oh, how exciting. It was fantastic,
and I had so much fun. It was exhausting because I am such an introvert, and to feel like I have to be on all the time, and, you know, but it was really wonderful and energizing at the same time because I got to meet great folks and great booksellers and great readers, and so that's good. But, you know, and it's always the hardest part of the writing thing has always been the balancing act for me. You know, being the writer who sits behind the computer, but also doing what I need to do to be like, have my public author persona and, you know, doing the Facebook stuff and getting out there and doing the events and finding a way to balance that and to, you know, still have time to do the work I need to do, but also be promoting the book that I have, you know?
Yeah.
So it's,
yeah.
It's always tricky.
Do you use Twitter?
I do not. I did for a while and I hated it.
Okay.
I absolutely, and everyone kept saying it's going to become more naturally to you. Keep doing it. Keep doing it. It's going to get easier, and it never got easier. So I stopped.
Yeah.
I do Facebook, although that said, I haven't in a few weeks been on Facebook. But for a while, I was doing really well with Facebook. And you've just inspired me. I should post something on Facebook.
Okay.
So I try to do that. And, you know, I don't blog. I feel like
it's not the writing that you do.
Yeah.
That would be hard. I would think that would be hard. Like, if the marketing writing is not the kind of writing that you do.
Yeah.
Or that you're drawn to.
Yeah. And I feel like I have a limited amount of time and brain power for doing stuff like that. And I should, for me, that's best put to use sitting in front of the computer and writing the best story I can.
Yeah.
You know, instead of getting exhausted trying to come up with some brilliant blog post. And, you know, I do guest blogs for people, and I do Q&As on people's blogs, and I do stuff like that, and that's fun.
Okay.
If I don't have the commitment to, like, oh, I have to write a blog and I have to do this post.
You mentioned that you have a daughter.
Yes.
How old is she?
She is almost, she'll be 10 at the end of this month.
Okay. So she's, does she ever ask to read your books?
She does, and she has not yet.
Okay. I wondered what the age is where you will let her read your books.
That's a good question. That's something that we're grappling with, because she's always picking them up and starting, and I think she's just looking for swears. And actually, The Winter People I dedicated to her.
Yes.
Because of the game that she had me play, because that game was the original inspiration for the Ruthie and Fawn storyline. And I didn't tell her that I was going to dedicate it to her, so I waited until we had the finished box of books, and the box of books got delivered to the house, and I opened it up, and I opened up the front page, and I opened it up to the dedication, and I showed it to her, and her face just lit up, and she was so happy, and the first thing she said was, "Mom, can I please bring this to school to show my teachers and all my friends? I promise we won't read any of it or look for any swears."
So what did you say?
I said, "Absolutely." And she went to school, and she came back, and she had several book orders from her teachers. Well, my math teacher wants this, wants a copy. And
cool.
So it was great.
That's great.
She handed out bookmarks, too. She's a good little marketer. But, yeah, I don't know. I mean, she's reading, she does read some creepy stuff. She was reading, like, Goosebumps books. And, you know, my niece was reading Stephen King when she was 10, so she read my first book, Promise Not to Tell, when it came out. I just don't know that Zella's quite there yet. I think I'll have a sense of when she's there.
Yeah, you'll probably know.
Yeah, I'll probably know.
Yeah.
But, yeah, she goes to all my readings, and she likes listening to me read. And she actually picked up on my second book, Island of Lost Girls, and started reading it and kind of lost interest after the first few pages.
Right, well, they're not children's books.
They're not, exactly.
I mean, they are, you know, in some ways very exciting, but they're not children's books.
They're not.
So even though the excitement is probably there on certain pages for her, the whole thing might be a little bit...
Yeah, old. Eventually. I have this goal maybe one day to... And I keep talking to her about it, maybe writing a young adult book or a young reader book. And I think that would be something creepy, you know? But not too creepy.
Yeah.
So that might be fun. But, yeah, she likes to write, too. She likes to write creepy stories.
Oh, good.
Yes.
I just listened to the new Joe Hill book. Do you read Joe Hill?
Oh, I do.
So that was creepy. I was reading your book and listening to his, and
yes,
I'm like, I'm never sleeping again.
Yes. No, that was really, it was Christmas Land, Christmas Town, Christmas...
Nosferatu was the name of it, but it's about that, Christmas Land.
No, Christmas I did Christmas. Oh, that was creepy stuff.
Creepy.
That was very creepy.
Very creepy. Yeah, but so he's another famous child of the horror writer. Or scary writer. Okay, so I know that you changed publishers recently, and you are now with...
Doubleday. I was with HarperCollins, and my first five books were with Harper, and I had one editor. I was really lucky, because I had one editor for the first five books, which I understand is pretty unusual to stay with one editor for so long, and she was absolutely wonderful, and she was the editor who read my very first book, Promise Not to Tell, and believed in me, and we worked really hard and we worked really well together, and she was fantastic. And she actually ended up moving to San Francisco because of her husband's job, and she was still my editor even when she moved. But then she decided to leave her job and not be an editor anymore and do some other life things. And it was around that time that I was working on The Winter People.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, my agent and I decided it was time for, you know, to kind of see what else was out there and see what else we could do. And it felt like a different book. It felt like a bigger book.
It's so very different in presentation. You don't have the same kind of cover that you used to have.
We don't.
Cover with a child's face on it.
Yeah.
Usually,
yeah.
Often.
So I felt like it was time for a change.
And reading it felt like a very different book. It wasn't a story about one person.
Yeah.
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 I'm not sure that they all were, but.
Yeah. No, I just feel like it's kind of a bigger in, you know, in the time sense, because I did the historical thing, but there's also more points of view and.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, it was exciting. So it was kind of a fresh start.
Yeah.
And I had several publishers who were interested, and I ended up having conversations with all the editors, and we talked about their vision for the book, and they listened to my vision, and I went with the one I was most excited about, and I have been absolutely thrilled with what Doubleday has done. And
okay.
I really have. They've just been fantastic. And I love the cover.
I love the cover.
I love that it's The Winter People. That was one other big thing. I did not want to change the title. You know, that was my original title. I felt like that needed to be the title. If I was going to work with an editor who was going to make me change it, that was a deal breaker for me.
So did you say that while you were still talking to several editors?
I didn't say it was a deal breaker. I said, how do you feel about the title?
Okay.
And what's your, you know, what are your thoughts on what the cover might be? And
Yeah,
because I was ready to move away from the girls' faces and do something a little different.
Yeah.
And my editor I actually have two wonderful editors at Doubleday I'm working with, and they are just fantastic.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, and really listen to me and listen to my ideas for what I wanted the cover to be like, and this is just like my dream cover. And
it's beautiful.
And they did a beautiful, beautiful
job. It's not even just
there.
Beautiful, but it's like shiny on the inside, too, and it's got this kind of,
like
glistening.
Like a pearlescent
quality. Yes,
kind of,
exactly.
Yeah,
it's very cool.
They did a beautiful, beautiful job with it.
Yeah. And so I was going to ask if you had changed agents as well, but no, you stayed with your agent.
No, I love my agent.
Yeah.
My agent is behind any success I've ever had.
Okay.
He's wonderful.
And it's Daniel Lazar.
Yes,
okay.
And he is absolutely wonderful. And yeah, every time I write a new book, you know, it goes first to my partner, Drea, and she reads and edits, and then it goes to Dan, and he tells it like it is.
Yeah.
And he'll tell me when I'm being lazy, and he'll tell me, you know, when I can do better, and he'll tell me when something's really good, and I trust his judgment 100%. And
okay.
He's absolutely wonderful. So.
All right, great. You mentioned Ruth Rendell in this book. I can't remember where. Maybe there was a Ruth Rendell book sitting on a table or something. And
yes.
I was just wondering if she's a favorite of yours.
Yeah, I really like her.
Okay.
Alice, Ruthie's mother, who goes missing. So when they're searching through her bedroom, they found a Ruth Rendell
paperback. That's what it was. Okay.
And half a Hershey bar, I think.
Do you like those two?
That's my bedside table.
Okay. So I was going to ask you, what are you reading right now?
I'm not reading anything right now because
I'm too busy.
Hard at work revising.
Right.
I've been reading about motels in America. I've been reading
for you. I've just stayed in a lot of motels.
Have you? Yeah, I've been reading about motels, and I've been reading about Alfred Hitchcock.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Alfred Hitchcock is going to play a part in a way in my new book.
So well, I was going to ask what you're working on now, so can we talk about
that
too?
I'm working on a completely new book, and I actually turned in the very first draft just before Winter People came out to my editor, and so I'm working away on revisions now, and it is creepy. It's set at a roadside motel in a small town in Vermont, and it takes place in there are three storylines, the 1950s, the late 80s, and the present day.
Okay.
And it kind of shows the motel and the town through the different time periods, and this is when the highway was coming through, and the highway came through Vermont sort of later on in the 50s and early 60s and sort of changed the face of Vermont, and so I play with that a little bit in the book. And
do you invent your small towns always?
I do.
Yeah, okay.
I do. I invent my small towns, but I put historical things like the highway coming through, and I set them in sort of real geographical areas in my mind so that I can...
Right, you're putting a town in someone's backyard.
I'm putting a town in someone's backyard. And yeah, actually, when I did the Winter People, and when I do invent these towns, I have to make maps of the towns. Mm-hmm. So I actually like have the map of the town so that I don't mess up. So I know where Main Street is, and I know what shops are on it, and I know what streets, and I know how to get from this place, and I know how you would get from the downtown of the town to this character's house. And
do you also do a chronology or a timeline to keep yourself grounded in when anything happened?
Absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely. Otherwise, I'm just a mess. Especially when I'm playing, when I've got different timelines and I've got many different characters, it would just be a mess.
Yeah.
And even then, I feel like I'm being really careful, and I have all these charts and timelines, and I have a timeline for each character and a timeline for each story, each time period. Even then I mess up, and the copy editors will catch something, and I'm like, this couldn't have happened then. I'm like, oh, you're right. How could I have missed
that? They didn't have cell phones in 1984.
Copy editors are wonderful. Like in the Winter People, I kept using the word ponytail in the 1908 section, and no one used the word ponytail then. ponytails came into, I forget when, but...
In the 50s or something.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
What did they call it? Tying your hair back.
Tying your hair back. You know?
That needs a word.
Clearly. But yeah, I'm very excited about the new book, and I'm working away on it. I don't want to say too much about it because it's very much a work in progress.
Sure.
And anything can happen, but I'm really excited about the setting, and it's pretty creepy. It's got a definite sort of monster element, possibly.
Ooh, that's fun.
Yeah.
I wanted to, without getting too specific or giving anything away, I wanted to just read one little bit here from toward the end of The Winter People and ask you about it. This is an emotional scene that I will say ends in a violent moment, okay? But I just wanted to read this because I love the way that you use detail to kind of introduce the emotion of this scene and to introduce what's going to happen. So... this is from Sarah's point of view, and it's a kind of a flashback to her child self. Turn back, he said fiercely over his shoulder. That's her father. But I did not listen. I walked farther behind, putting more distance between us. We went through the orchard, the trees hanging with unripe apples and pears, misshapen and spotted with blight. Some of the fruit had fallen and lay rotting on the ground, attracting hornets drawn to its sweetness. The black flies found us when we were past the Devil's Hand, swarming in tiny little clouds. Toadstools sprouted here and there, inky and poisonous. The path bent and turned, moving downhill. So I'll stop there, and I don't want to talk about what the plot's about to do, but I do want to talk about what that paragraph does, mm-hmm. which I just, that really stood out to me. And actually, the very beginning of the book has a similar paragraph that you read earlier about the flora of where she is playing near the Devil's Hand, and it's very different.
It is very different.
But those details kind of herald important moments. So anyway, if you can just talk about your use of detail there.
I think that I'm sort of turning the forest and the setting into something a little darker and spookier than in the early chapter where she's there with the trout lilies and the jack in the pulpits.
Where she's still innocent.
Where she's still innocent, yeah. And here she's been through a lot and something terrible has happened and is about to happen.
Right.
And the, you know, even the brightest, most wonderful landscape can look pretty bleak when you're under an emotional weight.
Right.
You know, you're going to notice things like, not things like the pretty flowers, but like the toadstools and the fact that the fruit is misshapen and spotted with blight and everything is sort of ruined.
And that's it, isn't it? It's what you notice in a certain state of
mind. It is. Absolutely. Yeah. That's, yeah. That's,
now, is that the kind of thing that you would have been likely to write in revision? Like after you've put everything on the dining room floor, or is that something that you...
I honestly can't remember. That might, you know, bits and pieces of it might have come in the very first thing, but that's something, you know, all those details, the layering of the details are things that I would really work on in revision, you know.
Yeah.
Like when I'm going through with my senses and trying to really, you know, make everything as atmospheric as possible, whatever that means to each scene, and, you know, make landscape and setting play a key role and...
Yeah, I enjoyed that. Yeah. I enjoyed noticing how different those details were than the earlier
and
ones.
I think that really affects the mood and gives you a sense of what's happening.
Yeah.
Kind of puts a shadow across everything.
It is. It's true. Okay, thanks. So I am actually just starting to work on my first ghost story.
Ooh, exciting.
I've always been drawn to ghost stories, and I want to give it a try. So I'm asking if you could give advice to people like me who are just starting to
write
their first ghost story, or we can open it up to creepy stories, let's say.
I think have fun with it. You know, there's that write what you know motto that everyone hears over and over. I like to go with write what scares you.
Mm.
You know, think about the things that scare you the most and kind of draw on that and draw on your own personal fears and the things, you know, that I did a lot with my, when I was a kid, I was afraid of the closet, like so many kids are, you know, and I played with that a lot in this book. So kind of go back into your own earliest fears. And I think that we all have these kind of primal fears. And, you know, I get letters and emails and stuff from people all the time saying, you made me afraid of the closet again, and I hadn't been afraid of the closet since I was a kid. So I think it's like reawakening old fears.
Yeah.
I think that's part of it. And, you know, people do ghost stories all kinds of different ways, but I feel like a ghost story for me really works when it's anchored in the real world somehow,
mm-hmm.
and you feel like this could be me, this could really be happening, like this... This character and this setting and this family feels really believable to me. So I'm right there with them. And oh my gosh, this unbelievable thing is happening. And yet you've got this grounding of the reality of, you know.
Absolutely.
And I think that really works. I had an editor once with my first book, Promise Not to Tell, who was interested in it and ended up passing on it. But she gave me this great, we had a conversation and she said, you know, you need to come up with rules for the ghost. And I do that every time I have anything supernatural going on, as I think about the rules for the ghost. You know, why does she come back now? What can she do? What can't she do? What, you know, what power does she have in this world? Why is she coming back now? What brings her back? You know, so really thinking about your ghost and giving the ghost some rules.
That's a great idea.
And I like
that.
That's
true, because when you read a story where absolutely anything can happen at any moment and you're not expecting it, and three quarters of the way through something happens that wasn't already established as possible, it kind of loses its credibility, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I think that's important. And, you know, and they can be kind of crazy, outlandish rules, but there need to be rules, I feel like.
Absolutely.
And I feel like that really helps, because, you know, and I don't like the books that pull the evil twin at the last minute routine.
Yes,
you know,
right?
Things like that. It's like, oh, come on. You can do better than that. You know, what do you mean the ghost can do that? The ghost hasn't been able to walk through walls all along, and now it's walking through walls and actually strangling people. No, ghosts can't do that. You didn't show me that the ghost could do that early on, so I'm not going to believe that now.
Right, right, right. Exactly.
You know.
Well, that's great advice. So. Well, Jennifer McMahon, thank you so much. The book is The Winter People, and it's published by Doubleday. So thank you for speaking
with
me.
Thank you so much. It was really fun. Thank you.
So that was an interview with Jennifer McMahon, the Vermont author. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by Calamity and Crow's Trading Post, twisting fresh tie-dyes for individuals, businesses, and organizations with standards like eyeballs, Jerry Bears, peace signs, and their signature tie-dyed mule, custom artisan tie-dyes that rock. Contact Calamity and Crow's Trading Post on Facebook for more information. If you're interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. I also have a new website up, and you can get to the show by way of my website, and that is shelaughswithoutus.com. From there, you'll be able to get to the show and to a recent blog that I actually wrote with my husband about a bike trip that we took up the East Coast recently, and I'm going to start a new blog there, too. So shelaughswithoutus.com, that's the website. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And do remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you are listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.